Good evening. I would like to call the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Today is March 20th. It is 6:03 p.m. We are in the Davis Room 106 of the State Capitol. Today we have present with us Representative Kevin McCabe. Representative Tom McKay is not here. I think he will be here, though. Representative Cliff Groh, Representative Andrew Gray, Representative Jamie Allard, and myself, Chair Carpenter, and we're ready to go. Let's see who else is in the room. The legislator sitting back there, just a bunch of friendly faces here to join us this evening. Thanks for coming in. I'd like to remind committee members and those in the audience, please silence your cell phones. We don't have any rings going on. Staff assisting us tonight will be Kevin Allen with House Records and Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO. Kendra Broussard will be our committee aide for this evening. We have one agenda on the item, tonight. We'll have a presentation by Zachary Christensen, Managing Director, and Ryan Frost, Senior Policy Analyst from Reason Foundation. We'll be going over an overview of costs and risks of proposed public retirement plan changes. Are we ready to go with the presentation? We are. Look at that. We're ready to go. Okay. Gentlemen, will you please come forward and introduce yourselves, put your name, give us your name, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Hello. For the record, my name is Zachary Christensen. I'm here representing the Pension Integrity Project at Reason Foundation. I've been working on pensions for several years. We've done I'll kind of give you the intro of what we do as an organization a little bit later here, but I just personally have been working on pensions for several years, up to 7 years now, working through different types of reforms, working with experts on several different types of ways to analyze and evaluate the costs of pension reforms.
My name is Ryan Frost, Senior Policy Analyst with the Pension Integrity Project at Reason Foundation. I've been here about 4 years. Prior to that, I spent 7 years as the Senior Research and Policy Manager for the Police and Fire Pension System in Washington State.
Let's go.
Okay, as we keep going, if you will remember to kind of introduce yourself, your name, before you start speaking, that way the recorder can know who is speaking. That would be great. Thank you.
Sure thing. Okay. All right. The Pension Integrity Project at Reason Foundation. So we're a nonprofit think tank. We do Reason Foundation does a lot of policy analysis on a wide variety of subjects all over the country. We're mostly engaging at the state legislature level. The Pension Integrity Project is a specific team that we specifically examine pensions and retirement plans, public retirement plans all over the country. We've engaged in over 60 reforms, and we've seen a lot of different types of reforms. We engage in lots of different types of retirement plans. This is the about page to kind of give you an idea of what we do, how we do it. Our approach is basically that we understand that retirement plans are important, very important for a lot of people. And there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in retirement plans, and that's rightfully so. It's also a bit of a numbers issue. It's a numbers question. So we approach retirement analysis trying to demystify a lot of the long-term costs and all the various numbers that are involved in any of these decisions that need to be made. We do that with actuarial modeling. We develop models and also use independent actuarial modeling to help develop analyses for a lot of different plans. And basically what we're trying to do is give legislators like you an idea of what exactly the price tag would be for whatever particular policy decision you're considering at the time. We do this as consultants, basically. It's all pro bono work. We're not contracting out with any governments or anything like that. It's all just for your information type of analyses. We also do a lot of peer-to-peer mentoring, so we'll help a lot with some of the things that we've seen in other states you'll see a lot of similar challenges from state to state, and we're able to bring that perspective.
We had a pause there. Let the record reflect that Representative Tilton joined us at 6:06 p.m. Please continue.
Okay. We also wanted to share with you what we're all about, what our policy objectives are. Generally, our perspective on retirement plans is they should have stated and clear goals, every retirement plan, and I think most people would agree on what those goals should be. Keeping promises is, of course, the top priority that we'll deal with usually. Promises, pension and just retirement promises made to public workers are usually constitutionally bound, so that's something that does need to be paid. And we approach these issues from that perspective, understanding that it's important that people made decisions, they made employment decisions based off of what was promised to them. And it's not only is it illegal to not carry out with that, but it's also immoral not to give those benefits that are promised to workers. We're also focused a lot on retirement security, making sure that retirement is sufficient, that it's going to be enough of a retirement benefit to provide an adequate retirement benefit once they are done working. We're also very concerned with predictability, risk reduction. These are things that we'll get into a little bit more depth a little bit later here when we give some analyses, but the ability to make sure that the state or the government is able to predict what the cost of a benefit will be is important, and making sure that the risks are balanced accurately. And then we also affordability, attractive benefits, making sure that you're able to recruit and compete with other employers, and then good governance as well. I wanted to give a brief history of Alaska's retirement systems. This is very likely something that most of you are familiar with, but just to give a little bit of a baseline of our perspective of what's going on here in the state. TRS and PERS were established decades ago. Pension plans at the time were very very predictable mechanism for establishing retirement benefits. It was something that you could really count on as far as returns go. Things have changed significantly since then. In the early 2000s, significant growth, the state experienced significant growth in unfunded liabilities. That's once again mostly due to market turbulence, and there's a lot of other factors that contributed to that as well. But that's something that was mostly experienced nationwide. Most pension plans across the country saw that. In 2006, it was actually a 2005 reform, but beginning 2006, the pensions were closed to new hires in the state, and now the primary and the only retirement plan for public workers is the defined contribution plan. And then going back to 2006 all the way up to today, there's been frequent efforts to bring back that defined benefit pension plan. And then last year, there were two bills that even passed in the House, HB 55 and HB 220, did not get through the Senate. But those were bills that were attempting to reopen the pension plan, one for public safety workers and the other for all public workers. And it also allowed it opened it up so that those who had entered into the DC plan ever since going back to 2006 would have the option to switch to the DB plan, using a mechanism that basically allowed them to use their benefit that they had earned and buy into a defined benefit pension. We've done some analysis on those bills. We engaged last year on some of these, trying to bring some perspective to the costs that would be involved. Since that time, since last year, we've actually developed actuarial modeling on both Alaska TRS and PERS. We have accurate modeling that's accurate up to 30 years. We're able to project out exactly what the state would be looking at as far as annual contributions, the unfunded liabilities that they'd be experiencing, and we're able to apply whatever scenario you could come up with basically as far as returns go, market returns. We were able to use that model now to apply retroactively the bills that were proposed last year, HB 55 and 220, and looking at those bills, if let's say theoretically they had passed those bills last year, the legislature had passed those bills last year, and then experienced the negative 4% loss in returns, which is what the plan experienced just this last year, that would have added an additional $33 million to the public safety plan through HB 55. That's $33 million in pension debt, unfunded liabilities. And it would have added $254 million for both PERS and TERS combined if HB 220 had passed.
Thank you. Can we pause here for just a second for questions? We didn't talk about this beforehand, so I hope you're okay with some interruptions.
Yeah, we love it.
Representative McCain.
So thanks. I just want to be very clear for my constituents because sometimes they get lost in the numbers, and I know there's several tens of them watching, I suppose. But so we heard, I was on the committee that heard HB 22 this year, the very first time. We had a fiscal note of $5.6 million-ish, and I remembered HB 55 from last year. And so I think what you're saying is the negative 4.8% is way less than they planned. They planned 7.5% for HB 55, I believe, and HB 22 this year. So, and the market actually was not all that bad. So I'm not real sure. I guess I just want to highlight that had we passed HB 55 last year, we would be $33 million more in the hole this year than we are now because of that negative return. So, and I think you're going to get into this. I reread through there, but the 7.5 seems a little bit, optimistic. Would that be?
Is that a question?
Yeah, that's a question. That's yeah.
Are you going to get to that in
I think so.
Slide?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Chair, we are definitely going to get into that. But yes, to answer the question briefly, the plan last year assumed 7.35% returns. They're not saying that they're going to achieve that every single year, but over the long term, and then every year that happens to fall below that creates some pension debt, some unfunded liability, and that's what we've calculated here.
Thanks.
Ryan Frost, reason just to kind of further answer that question. The reason, through the chair, the reason that those dollar figures are so high is just due to that annuitization mechanism of allowing all those years of service to be purchased in the defined benefit plan using a 7.38% discount rate as kind of the annuitization factor. So essentially, when you use a higher rate, the members will be able to purchase more service credit. That's kind of the reason, I think, behind maybe using a higher rate. And so when that is, all that is transferred over and then in year one there's losses, then they can hit pretty significantly, whereas if this was just a brand new tier, those figures would not be anywhere nearly as high.
So follow up with that?
Representative McCain.
Thank you. So, again, we heard that this the first – hearing in community and regional affairs, we heard that this was a very conservative bill, that $5 million was all it was going to cost us, and it was virtually almost word for word the same as HB 55. Other than the 7.35, I had forgotten that it was a little bit lower, but and yet here we are 365 days later, and it would have been $33 million cost to us. Is that about right?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that's correct. I'm assuming that fiscal note probably just assumed going forward that the plan would always hit their assumed rate of return, and so that's where that increased cost in the fiscal note would come from. We tend to look at things a little bit differently.
Okay. So follow up. One.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Sorry. Thanks for your patience. So six times higher than the fiscal note that we got at HB 22.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, yes, then just in year one, that's what the increased cost should be.
Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I wanted to ask about early 2000s significant growth in unfunded liabilities. It's my understanding that prior to 2002, the defined benefit system was well-funded. And then from 2002 to 2004, Mercer, which was the actuarial firm that was advising the state, gave the state very bad advice to invest $0 in, And then we had a huge stock market crash along with skyrocketing healthcare costs. And this created a perfect storm that led to enormous unfunded liabilities. I just felt that context was lacking there, because I think that perfect storm led to us having unfunded liabilities, but prior to 2002, we were doing okay, was my understanding.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, that's correct. I don't know if the Mercer error would have contributed to the total unfunded liability. As Zachary mentioned, almost every plan in the country saw a significant dip in their assets in the early 2000s. And the plans that kind of were able to crawl back are the ones that pared down their risk a little bit faster than others. But I think that was absolutely a contributor to that.
I have a question. I raised my hand for some reason. I forgot that I'm the chair.
Go ahead.
So as we're talking about long term, we happen to be having a conversation about what happened just recently. Would like to just help us keep a longer term picture here. That's what we're trying to answer the question to. As we're asking questions about what would be best for the state going forward, is it a fair position for us to be considering those perfect storms that might happen with the system that we choose? And to the extent that we can manage those perfect storms with the system that we choose, we would minimize the impact that perfect storms might have on our state's finances. Is that something that we can, that we should be thinking about?
Yes, Zachary Christensen here. Yes, exactly. Those perfect storms can happen, and that's exactly what our cost analysis does. Is it applies those situations to make sure that at the very least, TERS and PERS can survive the next 20 years if they happen to run, if they happen to play out like the last 20 years did. That's at the very minimum, and it's also valuable to look at, you know, applying a little bit more stress as well. That's the way that we produce these cost evaluations.
Okay. Would you mind a little bit?
Representative McCabe.
So just to add a little bit more context to that whole time period, oil was over $100 a barrel for most of that time, if my memory serves. So it may have been a storm, but I'm not so sure it was a perfect storm.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Representative Groh.
In terms of the perfect storm and medical costs, were you aware that the healthcare costs in Alaska in the 2000-2004 period were so incredible that the annual rate of growth in the cost of providing medical coverage was 14.5%, the annual rate of growth, and so much so that in this period in the 2000s, a surgeon could leave a job in Seattle, move to Alaska, almost quadruple his income for one-third less work. I mean, the perfect storm sort of is almost sort of the rise in healthcare costs in Alaska in the early 2000s and the decade of the 2000s was such that I don't think you're capturing it. It's more like a lightning bolt split Earth in half in terms of what happened to Alaska in terms of healthcare cost inflation at the time. So much so that Mercer, the actuary, couldn't believe it. And that's why they ended up paying the big settlement. Was they saw what was happening in healthcare cost growth in Alaska, and they refused to believe it. So they went back to their regular assumptions, and then they lied about it. So that ended up being the essential basis for the big settlement. Were you gentlemen aware of these facts, of just how unusual that period was in the 2000s Alaskan healthcare cost inflation?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I was not aware of how crazy the healthcare costs were. I would say that the pension trust and the healthcare trust are two separate trusts that are managed independently. So it's we're just focusing on the pension trusts right now. I know the healthcare trust is in great shape. It's probably the best funded, frankly, OPEB plan in the country. Most OPEB plans are just as bad as the pension systems are.
Follow up, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative Groh.
The two big factors, as Representative Gray was saying, were changes in the stock market and this amazing sort of world-beating, beyond belief, inflation healthcare cost that was especially limited to some special factors in Alaska, that, by the way, does not exist now. And I just, you know, Alaska's different here. and it's changed over time. And just be useful for you, for everybody and talking about this to understand that. So anyway, thanks a lot, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Eller.
Thank you. And through the chair, can you go back? Because you made a comment. Did you say best funded in the country?
Through the chair, Representative, one of the best funded, absolutely.
Can you say one of the best? I want you to expand on that. A comment, if you could, please.
Sure. The healthcare trust for Alaska is, I think, right now over 100% funded and projected to be, continue to be over 100% funded. The pension trust, on the other hand, is $6.1 billion or so in debt. And because they're separate trusts, we don't really look at them as anything remotely the same. You have to treat them much differently. Ongoing costs are much different in both systems. And so as far as the OPEB plan for Alaska, I think, yeah, it's better funded than the average, one of the better funded. The pension system being $6.1 billion in debt after the pension system being closed for this long is maybe a little more concerning.
Thank you, Chair.
Please continue.
Okay. All right. Zachary Christensen speaking again. I wanted to go through some history, a little bit more history, just to show you the history of the funding. So we're going to show a couple of charts here. First showing PERS, the growth of the unfunded liability. So again, this is pension debt. This is promises made to workers in Alaska that at the moment of reporting, the state did not have funds for. So this is basically a debt that is growing. It's also keep in mind that as a debt, it's accruing interest at a very high rate, a rate that's basically the assumed rate of return, which we mentioned was, it started at 8% and slowly came down to 7.35, and now it's down to 7.25 this most recent year. We're also projecting these 2022 numbers. The latest reporting available is 2021, so you'll notice that the numbers add up to a little bit more. It's also notable these are actuarial numbers, so this accounts for smoothing that'll happen over multiple years. But this gives a history of what's been going on with PERS. You'll also notice the blue line, after dipping down in the early 2000s and having a little bit of a resurgence, it came back down, and it's been very, very slow to recover. So that leaves the fund still just 70% funded, meaning 30% of the dollars that have been promised and the retirement benefits that have been promised to workers. The funding is not available right now. It's not there. So it needs to be, it's the type of thing that needs to be handled quickly, or else it'll be harder to handle down the road as interest is accruing on all this. And then we mentioned it earlier, we had a discussion and we'll talk about it a little bit more later, but the assumed rate of return being at 7.35 right now, if that is reduced, I'm sorry, 7.25 right now, if that is reduced down more, which we believe is a very, very high probability will happen. If that's reduced down more, that'll reveal more unfunded liabilities. So that was a main driver to this growth, the fact that assumptions were too high at the time and having to adjust that down. That will very likely continue to happen. So this price estimate that we're giving now, that's reported by both plans, is still very likely understating the issue for the state. I wanted to show you the TERS, the teacher's plan as well.
Oh, guys, jump in. Ryan Frost. I just thought one interesting point about this chart that you'll see on both the PERS and TERS side is that there's massive infusion in 2014 into PERS and TERS. There's $1 billion in 2014 to PERS, $2 billion to TERS. And so that kind of spike you're seeing in assets there and funded status was mostly just due to those large infusions.
This chart looks a little differently, but it's mostly the same story with the teacher's plan. It's a little bit better funded. It is 82% funded. It's still not fully – the state still does not have the amount that they need to fulfill promises that are made to teachers. So there we go. This is another way to visualize what we just showed. It's basically showing the orange line, which is the promises that are made to pensioners and to members. And then the blue line is what's going on with the asset pool that's supposed to pay for these benefits that are being promised. So Ryan mentioned the infusion there. You'll see a couple of moves there in the asset line. But for the most part, it's having trouble keeping up with that orange line. And that's been something consistent for over 20 years now.
I think we had a question from Representative Allard on slide 6.
Thank you. And through the chair. So promise made, promise kept. Give our word. I get it. If we continue at the pace we're going with our defined benefits, I mean, promise kept, got to keep it going. What's going to happen? We hear they want to add to it. They want more defined benefits for teachers and what and tier four. What's going to happen? I see it up to 2021. Are we getting to a slide that tells me what it looks like in 2023, 2025, and also?
Through the chair, yes. Yeah, we're just giving the historical perspective first. We're going to show you the modeling that shows the next 30 years, what that will look like, you know, applying the proposed reforms.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, this is Zachary Christensen speaking still. This is a historical analysis, again, just looking at the returns that the plan that the plans have been able to achieve. They both invest together. The blue line represents what they were expecting. Very little movement there. It's you know, slight, very slight and slow adjustments to that. But if you were able to see that a little more detailed, you would see it's going from 8 down to the current 7.25. The gray line represents the actual returns that are coming in each year, and you'll notice it's very volatile. It's kind of hard to really read much into any of that, but the yellow and the orange lines try to make sense of it a little bit to show exactly how they're doing over time. The orange line is a 10-year average. You'll see that they struggled for the first 10 years and going on, and now we're starting to see a little bit improvement there, but it's very what you want to see is that orange line equally above the blue line as it is below the blue line. That's the main problem here, and that's created a lot of underfunding. This answers the question Senator McCabe had earlier about returns, return assumptions. This is a very complicated chart, but basically each of these columns is a bell curve, and there's a lot of different perspectives on what the next 10, 30 years are going to look like as far as market returns. There are market experts that have that produce forecasts for a either 10, 15, sometimes 30, 20 years usually, the furthest they go out. But they've produced forecasts, and depending on the mix of investments that the plans are using currently, we've applied those assumptions and those forecast to what Alaska plans are using. So using that, we're able to see exactly how the Alaska plans have built out their expectation of 7.25. You can also see historically how they've hit below that. And then looking at some pension or looking at investment market experts like research affiliates, JP Morgan, BNY Mellon, you're able to see basically what they would expect to see for the plan over the next 10 years, which is very low, much lower than the current assumption. So again, that explains or warns that the current price estimates and the current debt estimates that are being given are likely understated, and there's likely to be more to be revealed as we go here.
So is there significance to the funds that you list across the top there? In blue, research affiliates, JP Morgan, BNY Mellon. Why choose those?
Oh, thank you for the question, Senator. Yes, it is. Those are all the ones that we know of that are available. We're trying to get a wide breadth of all the experts for market forecasts and all that. So there's a large collection of them. These are the main ones. So there's no we try to include all that we can find, really.
Ryan Frosky, Mr. Chair, most actuarial firms also use these same groups when they're kind of looking at their forecasts as well.
Okay. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, through the chair. So this is kind of a semi-Monte Carlo chart, really. I mean, you have gone through and queried a bunch of different analysts from all the different research affiliates, JP Morgan, BNY Mellon. But it looks to me like the most conservative would have been 5%. So really, hearing that HB 22 is a very conservative chart, maybe not so much. But I don't know. If you were recommending a possible rate of return to us, would you recommend 7.5 or would you be down closer to the 5% for if you're looking for conservative modeling.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, we would not recommend 7.25%. I think that would be the highest of any new tier I've seen opened for a rate. We've opened quite a number of new tiers. Most of them are around the 6 range, but these are all 4 or 5 years old at this point. Today, we might look at a lower number.
Thanks.
Oh, and Zachary Christensen here again. This is we don't need to go through all of this, but these are a couple of the takeaways from that Monte Carlo analysis, as it was labeled, which is accurate. We do call it that as well. So this is something that you can we can go through, and we're welcome to any questions on any of this. But in the interest of time, I thought we'd just move on, keep this thing moving.
Okay, so Ryan Frost again. So this is the section where I want to start digging in a little bit into the actual pension bills that are in the Alaska legislature right now. And there's 4 in particular that we want to talk about. 2 are the same. It's just the companion bill, and that's House Bill 22 and Senate Bill 35. Those are the companion bills that would put all public safety into the defined benefit plan going forward. Senate Bill 11 and Senate Bill 88 would encompass all employee groups, so police, fire, all public employees, all teachers. So there's what we see is there's really 4 problems with all these bills. Number 1 is just frankly poor plan design. It does little to balance the risks between employees and employers. I'm going to get into each one of these problems going forward, but I just wanted to list them all here on one page for you. Problem number 2, they haven't faced a lot of actuarial scrutiny. As Representative McCabe stated last year, they got a $5 million fiscal note. I think the most we've seen is maybe a 6-year cost figure from the plan actuaries, Buck. But that is frankly not anywhere near long enough to study what a pension reform proposal looks like. And so most actuarial firms will present at least a 30-year figure with some stress built in to show the range of possible outcomes. And so that's what we believe in, and that's what we do everywhere we work in as well. Problem number 3, Zachary already alluded to this a little bit, but pension cost increases are already on the horizon based on your current debt figure. The current assumed rate of return is far higher than the national average. Right now it's a kind of a race for pension plans to get down to a 6% assumed rate of return as fast as they can. Unfortunately, it's very expensive, so a lot of them aren't getting down as fast as they want. New York, for example, has a very well-funded pension system, and so they, instead of doing a step down, they said, we expect to earn 5.8% over the next 20 years. We're going to 5.8% right now because we don't want to add a bunch of debt to our pension system. CalPERS is taking – California Public Employees Retirement System, is taking a slightly different view. They are not as well funded, and so it would be next to impossible for their local governments to afford the pension benefit or the pension contribution increases. So they're saying every year we have a good return, we're just going to use those returns to buy down our assumed rate of return until we're at a point where we feel comfortable that we'll actually hit it going forward. I think their market analysis indicated they expected to earn 6 going forward, and that was done a couple years ago. And then problem number 4, which is, I think, probably should have been problem number 1, but we're here now. So is that, in our opinion, the pension swap is unlikely to solve the retention issues. We, as Zachary mentioned, we work across the country on pension reforms. We look at retention for different pension plans, and we have not seen any data that would support saying that one plan design retains employees more than another plan design. But again, I'll get into that in a couple slides. So go back to problem number 1, poor plan design. We've hit on this a lot, but it is by far the most important thing when you're talking about opening a new plan, is that the assumptions, which is the foundation of the plan, is accurate and strong. And right now the plan assumptions in all these bills are outliers among all other defined benefit plans, let alone ones that have opened in the last 5 years. Another issue is some bills close the DC plan to all new hires. We strongly believe that pension plans should benefit all employees, And shorter-term employees are much better off in the current plan than they would be under any sort of defined benefit plan. It also caps the employee contribution rates. I know there is some variability there between 8 and 10% for employees to pay, while employers, at least in the PERS system, and I believe under Senate Bill 88, even the TERS system, start at 12, and then any amount above that employee's 10 would be placed on the state and other employers. And then lastly, a few of the bills actually put, because of the current cap in contributions and PERS of 22%, by opening up this new tier, it actually would then put less money into PERS and require an even larger state contribution to cover that.
Can we just discuss that employees' contribution rate range between 8 and 10? What this is really saying is at one period in time, an employee's paycheck may have 8% reduced, or they'd be paying 8% of the cost, and at another time they'd be paying 10% of the cost.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Would the employee know that from time to time, or is it just going to happen automatically?
Generally, Mr. Chair, generally the board would adopt the rates. They would send out a notice to the employees, and then rates are typically set 2 years in advance, so they would know 2 years from now your rate will be going up to, you know, between 8 and 10. 8 is just where the employees would start at.
Okay. That seems like a 2-year notice that they're getting a pay cut eventually of their take home pay.
Mr. Chair, essentially that is what it would be for their checks.
Thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thank you. I'd like to focus on bullet number 4 there because we do have more than $6 billion in unfunded liability. When we first got it, in 2006, when we first got out of defined benefits, I think it was closer to 13. In the last 18 years or however long it's been, we have managed to pay half of it, and that's kind of only because Governor Parnell and I think Governor Palin put money, plussed it up significantly, and that's the back a few slides, that's the big plus that you see in the yellow line, if I'm not mistaken. So less money into underfunded legacy PERS tier. So what happens when that we can't pay that down? I mean, that just continues to accrue as a huge debt because it's obviously gathering interest and everything else. So what is that going to affect the people that are on retirement right now possibly? Or, I mean, I think we're constitutionally required to pay them, but if we're not paying down the big unfunded liability, that could be a problem, I would think.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I probably should have clarified this bullet point a little bit better. So what's happening here is that there's a capped contribution rate for non-state employers of 22%. So what the House Bill 22 would do is, because the DB rates are higher than what's going into the current DC plan, less of that kind of 22% than is the non-state employers paying down the debt. Now, the state pays what's called ADEC, Actuarial Determined Employer Contribution. So any amount that's above that would just mean the state has to put more money in. By saying put less money underfunded, that should really say non-state employers put less money in, which means the state has to pick up a larger portion of the unfunded liability.
Okay.
I apologize for that.
No worries.
Please continue.
Okay, so going back to problem number 2, this is something that we talked about a lot last year, but there was no publicly available long-term actuarial forecasting or stress testing performed by either the PERS or TERS actuaries. As I mentioned, the most we had seen is kind of a 6-year cost estimate using the plan's assumed rate of return and just showing what additional money would need to go in because the bills are a little bit more expensive than what the DC plan is. And so bullet 2 there, the supporters of the bills claim that tweaks to the new pension would eliminate financial risk to the state. But again, I'm not sure how somebody could say that because they've just not really faced a lot of actuarial scrutiny to support them, which is part of the reason why we did that 1-year look back to show that eliminating financial risk to the state doesn't equal the plan's $250 million, the new tier's $250 million in debt in 12 months. third bullet there, what happens to costs and unfunded liabilities if the experience differs from expectations? We've hit on that quite a bit, but legacy pension liabilities, any new pension liabilities in the DB plan, if they're currently priced at 7.25, any lowering of that just means that those liabilities are now either underfunded or the cost of those benefits has now risen up, and usually it's both, where ongoing costs are now higher and there's also some debt added in that has to be paid off over time. The proposed reform rollback would commit Alaska to unpredictable long-term costs. We have a few slides on that here pretty soon. Last year when we engaged on a few of these bills, we did not have, as Zachary mentioned, we did not have an actuarial model, but we've gotten one built by our consulting actuaries this year for PERS and TERS so that we can actually look at what the costs would be for each of those systems.
Representative Gray.
Can we go back to problem two? Through the chair. It's my understanding that the Senate is currently in the process of doing actuarial work, and that the plan would be that Buck Actuary would do an analysis every year, and that the Alaska Retirement Management Board would review Buck's actuarial work every year, and then on the fourth year, a third actuarial firm would review the ARMB's actuary work and Buck's work. So I'm not an economist. That seems like a lot of actuary scrutiny. If that's minimal, what level of actuary scrutiny would you suggest?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, when we talk about actuarial scrutiny, what you're describing is the ongoing pension valuation process that happens every year. So Buck does an actuarial valuation for TERS and PERS every single year. What we're talking about is when a large pension reform is coming before the legislature, typically what you see is the plan actuary will come to the legislature and give them a range of possible outcomes of what this bill could actually cost. So the ongoing actuarial evaluation is not going to tell you anything about what the cost could look like in 20 or 30 years. That's really what we used to call it a fiscal note in Washington State, but it's maybe a little bit more, it should be a little more inclusive than that. What we're really looking for is not so much that ongoing valuation process, but somebody to look at what this bill does and how it could change the plan over a long period of time.
Can I follow up?
Representative Gray.
Can we go back one slide to problem one? I just, as through the chair, about poor plan design, again, it's my understanding that if the funding fell below 90%, that retirees would lose their post-retirement pension adjustment, which would mean there'd be no adjustments for inflation, which is, I think, a good plan. There's no cost of living adjustment. I think that employees 8 to 10%, I mean, that's basically just moving the risk to the employee and saying, hey, if we're not getting enough money in, we're going to have to take more from employees' paychecks. Employees will have to give more to their retirement, which is different than our previous plan. So to me, again, that's not poor planning, that's good planning. And then the last thing is this, going back to the lightning bolt through the earth, is that the new defined benefit plan would keep our current defined contribution healthcare plan. So there's no Cadillac healthcare plan. It's a very minimal healthcare plan, which would reduce potential healthcare liabilities, even though we talked about how the healthcare plan is overfunded already. So that's not a real issue. But I just feel like that just focusing on those, we're kind of leaving out some of the new stuff. And again, I think that variable contribution is really sharing the risk.
Through the chair, Representative Gregg, you're absolutely correct that this proposed bill is much better than the previous defined benefit bill. The variable rates absolutely better than the fixed and statute rates. When we're talking about kind of best practices going forward for defined benefit plans, we have a paper out that describes a little bit of it. But instead of that 8 to 10% range, what we would typically recommend is just 50-50 between employee and employer for all costs. So normal costs plus any debt, instead of having kind of these fixed rates in statute, you just split it between the two. And that's what I think almost every pension reform I've seen defined benefit space has done. The other gives are absolutely they're better than the previous defined benefit tier, but compared to the current plan, which has zero risk for every new employee, there still is some added risk going forward. And the poor plan design, really, the first bullet there is by far the biggest issue, is that the assumptions are just completely out of what we would consider accuracy.
And through the chair, if I could also, Representative Gray, yeah, you do bring up some points here. These are compromises. These are improvements to helping control runaway costs in the future. We actually are able to show that in our analysis as well. But the scope of that actual improvement is very important, and we're going to be able to show that to you in a couple of slides here, and we can kind of discuss that further there.
I think if we can be patient with the questions and get through the slides, it might help us have a thorough discussion. Representative McCabe, do you have a question? Or?
More of a comment, if you don't mind. Okay. So you mentioned something earlier. You talk about stress testing. And then you just mentioned how the actuarial in the looking at this plan is not the ones that are auditing or sort of looking at it year by year by year. They're the ones that look at it in 30 years. We talked about Monte Carlo. I assume that the stress testing that they've done includes probably thousands of, that's what Monte Carlo is, right? Thousands of scenarios. You guys probably did the same thing. That's what you're talking about when you say the actuarial investigation. Is that right?
Through the chair, correct. Yes, Representative McCabe. Yeah, when we do run, what we would suggest is a stress test that does apply, as you said, 10,000 scenarios of that could happen, that are probable scenarios that could happen based off of our Monte Carlo analysis, so that we're able to show that the state can afford it even in the worst case scenario. And it doesn't have to be the absolute worst case scenario, but within a range, you can usually find like the middle 50% percentile or something within that. But there's usually that's useful to show that at the very least the state will be able to pay for the benefits that are being promised.
So quick follow up,
Representative McCabe.
That's not what Buck's doing, right? That's not what Buck is engaged to do at all.
Through the chair, to answer that, Representative McCabe, correct. Standard for actuarial evaluations, as they're called, the annual reports, they're not usually doing that. They're not applying stress to the plan to show what could be happening and what the state may be on the hook for.
Thank you.
Brian Frost, through the chair, Representative McCabe, yeah, the valuation is simply just a one-year look back at the plan experience. But we're talking about a fiscal note or an analysis. We're just talking about, look at this bill, tell us what could happen over 30 years compared to if nothing happened.
Thanks.
Last problem here, which I think is probably the most contentious or the one you've most heard about, is that the bill supporters are concerned with recruitment and retention challenges. They said they're having trouble recruiting and retaining members due to lack of a defined benefit pension plan for their members. As I mentioned, we have not seen any data that would show that one plan design benefits retention more than another. It's every state we work in, and there's been, exactly mentioned, there's some 60 reforms we've passed over the last 6 years. Every single state has talked about recruitment and retention with defined benefit plan as the reason to either keep it or get rid of it, or to move back toward it, excuse me. So we simply look at what is the data showing us across the country. It's showing us that all employees, frankly, are not really staying at their jobs at the rates that they did in the past. Pulled a statistic from National Police Association that said around 86% of the police stations across the country as of last year were facing a shortage of members. As you probably heard many times, Alaska is the only statewide public plan that doesn't offer a defined benefit plan for their public safety members. So I kind of wanted to look at is that the reason, or is there a lot of other reasons maybe that public safety is having shortages? Basically, on all the data we looked at, the defined benefit was not the factor that was keeping people. And then lastly, we do have an academic working paper. We looked at retention rates prior, the 5 to 10 years prior to the DC being enacted in 2006 versus the next 5 to 10 years. This is specifically for teachers, I should mention, and we didn't see any difference in retention rates. And there was actually a presentation to the Senate Finance Committee a couple weeks ago that looked at retention as well, and the retention rates for the DB and the DC groups were almost exactly the same.
Representative Groh, you have a question?
Are you aware of the special status with public employees in Alaska regarding Social Security?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, yes.
And Philip, what is that special status?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I know the teachers don't have Social Security. I think all state employees have access to the Social Security replacement, the SBS plan. Non-state public employees, is a little more mixed. I think maybe a third have access either to Social Security or the SBS. I'm not sure which the breakdown between the two is.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Groh.
Gentlemen, don't you think that special double whammy of no Social Security for a whole bunch of public employees in Alaska, in addition to the much less advantageous defined contribution system that the state went to in the mid-2000s, has a role in retention and in the problems, the very well-documented problems in retention and recruitment here in Alaska?
To the Representative Groh, I don't know if I would say that the DC is much less generous than the defined benefit plan. We have some benefit modeling coming up shortly. But when you think about a retirement, you probably heard the three legs of the stool, your pension, whether it's DB or DC, plus your Social Security, plus your personal savings. Missing that Social Security or SBS, no matter what plan design you have, is going to hurt a lot in retirement.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Groh.
Gentlemen, I just have to say that every experience that I've had, living in Alaska all my life, campaigning hard to get this job as legislator, and being a legislator now, just tells me that you're just flat wrong about this in terms of what the effects are. And I don't know whether it's because you're coming in from outside or you just haven't had the experience here in Alaska, but there's just a mountain of evidence that the combination of the Social Security problems here in Alaska and combined with the defined contribution system we moved to in the mid-2000s has caused enormous problems in public employment in Alaska with every agency. And I hear this constantly from supervisors and from employees. And I just have to say that, the gentleman, that this may be a problem here of your flying in or going around from state to state and not having the last experience. And I'm happy to hear your comment.
Perhaps, and I'll let you respond, but perhaps the data that you've reviewed would be of use to the committee in this assessment. And if you could provide that, or at least the links to where you were looking, that would be great. And then I would invite Representative Groh to show what data he's using to support his statement, and then we can evaluate that. Representative McCain.
Thank you. Take heart, gentlemen. I totally disagree with Representative Groh. I think you've done an admirable job of parsing out where Alaska is and where the rest of the country is. I've done some research myself coming from the airline industry. I've also looked at the Police Executive Research Forum, where they say that actually the state of Alaska, especially with regard to the DPS, is actually better than the rest of the lower 48, better than your 86%. I think the commissioner told us they had about a 5 or 6% vacancy rate, which kind of squares with what they're getting paid. Also, one thing that we keep forgetting is the largest fire department in the state, as well as the largest city police department in the state, are on their own retirement system. And you guys might not know that, but what's going to happen when we do this and they come all trooping in, all of the Anchorage Fire Department and all of the APD sworn officers come trooping into this plan? We have yet to explore how that works out. So I've done some other research. I think the nationwide EMS shortage right now is 30%+, and we are much better than that. So I appreciate the data that you've done, and I too would like to see, kind of where it comes from. But there's lots and lots of data out there. Some of the things, permission to read there, Mr. Chair, Many police agencies are discovering the traditional employment model, the promise of a steady job with good fringe benefits and a pension after 25 years, is not enough to keep today's workers from leaving for another police department or another profession. We have the same problem in the airline industry, the great hollowing out that we keep hearing about. I'm sorry, but it's a myth. It's our workforce that is deciding this, not our defined benefits program or our pension. In fact, the DPS did a survey in 2019 where they asked people, is the retirement going to keep you around? 9% were concerned with it. 10% were concerned with their pay. 21% were concerned with their job leadership. So it's not defined benefit, in my opinion, and I think that squares with what you in Alaska. It's not. I think that squares with what you have discovered.
Representative McCabe, will you provide that to the staff, and we'll get it out to the committee members when we're done here. So
absolutely.
Okay. Representative Allen.
Thank you. I have to agree with Representative McCabe, and part of what through the chair. I respect all my colleagues and what they say, but it just seems like anytime someone from the outside's looking in our world in Alaska, the excuse is, you don't know Alaska, but numbers don't lie. And I do know police officers, and listen, I support our men and women in blue, but the truth of the matter is their salaries, like, they're high. So you get a police officer that's been in for 5 years, I know this for a fact, he's making $170,000. Granted, a year, and granted, he's working overtime, but in order to make that, generally, you work more than 40-hour work week, so something has to give. That's an APD police officer, and he's one of the lowest paid. So it's interesting, our take that if we don't like your numbers, it's we're Alaska, you don't understand us. But I know you guys have significant experience, and I don't know if I actually heard a little bit of your backgrounds, but I did read your article in State of Affairs when we had some testimony in there. So I appreciate it. And I appreciate you coming from the outside looking in, and you don't have any gain in this. So you're just showing the numbers. So thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to ask a question regarding retention and the Social Security issue that you brought up. And the question I would have is, when we created a system in the past, why did we choose to not include Social Security as part of that system?
Mr. Chair, I believe that I'm not sure what the decision would be for the state, but generally every local government had that decision to make themselves. So they either chose back then they wanted to be in Social Security or not. I don't know if they still have that option today or if they would have to maybe just go only into the SBS or have neither. I'm not 100% sure, having access to either Social Security or the SBS plan is definitely a very important part of a retirement package.
So I ask the question knowing the answer. I believe that those entities that are not participating in Social Security or the SBS, they opted to do that at the time that they decided to move into this retirement system. So what I'm also looking at is the chair is what are the options here? If we're looking at defined benefits plan, is it also an option to move into those programs now if those entities so chose to do so, or are they prevented from doing so, right? That is also an alternative that we ought to keep on the table.
Yeah, I agree. Very important alternative.
Representative McCabe.
So one more, not to belabor this, but I believe that Anchorage APD firefighters have a 457 or 403B, and you guys probably didn't explore that much, but firefighters or the other non-state employees or even the state employees have the option to put more money into their 401s, their 457s, their 403Bs, and come out at the other end smelling pretty good, especially if they're making 177,000 or whatever they are a year. Would that be, then they can kind of control their own plan. They can control their own investments, where it's invested. They can give Fidelity or T. Rowe Price or whoever is managing it direction. Hey, I want to be aggressive, or I'm getting old. I want to be safe. That sort of thing. Correct.
To the chair, Representative McCabe, that's correct. The 457 plan, almost every public safety officer I've ever known has hammered that into every new recruit, the importance of starting to contribute to 457. And that the growth of that over a member's career, obviously it goes with them everywhere. So it's a good benefit as well.
Thank you.
And it kind of hits at that personal savings portion of that leg there, or the stool, excuse me.
Please continue.
Zachary Christensen speaking here. We'd like to now get into the modeling. We've been teasing it here a little bit, but the modeling portion of the work we've done, we have three different sections here for the three different bills. The first is House Bill 22 and Senate Bill 35, which are companion bills. They both do the same thing. They reopen the pension for public safety workers. And so we wanted to explore with our working model what that would do, what that would look like over the next 30 years. As far as the pension debt that would develop and the cost that it would that would mean for the state. And first to start out, I would like to show this came up earlier as well, and just to explain what's going on here. Usually, if a fiscal note or an analysis on a bill were to be performed and it was not stressed, it's very easy to show that there is little to no cost to any pension reform being done. So in this case, we're talking about opening up the pension plan again for public safety workers who have been employed for 15 years already and going forward as well. And that would have some effect. This is what our model shows would happen if they were to achieve their 7.25 return every single year. This is what the unfunded liability would look like. So it looks very much like not a very costly bill as far as pension debt goes. But if we begin to apply stress to it, it would look more like this. And again, this is modeling that's showing all of PERS. And so if we're reopening it just for the public safety workers, it's just a small subsection of the entire population of PERS, of all the members. So the impact is a bit muted still here, is still a little muted here. But this is what we're showing with the unfunded liability, the impact of HB 22 and SB 35. The impact would be, of course, higher unfunded liabilities. And what we're applying here is the stress that I'm talking about is we're talking about two recessions over the next 30 years. You can see those spikes in the years that we're applying a recession. And then all the years in between, we're applying 6% returns instead of the 7.25. So we're applying 6% because, as we showed earlier with our Monte Carlo analysis, short-term forecasts show that that's much more likely to happen. In fact, I believe the short-term analyses that we showed you earlier should probably around 5% may still be very likely as well. So we're showing we're basing this stress scenario based off of the last 20 years. It's very similar to the last 20 years. This is what if the last 20 years happen again over the next 20 years, this is very much what it'll look like for PERS. And then lastly, we're going to go through this graph and then table with all three bills, but this is to show the cost. This is basically an evaluation of the cost that would be applied to the state. The way you can understand the cost of a pension plan is, first of all, how much you can add up all of the annual contributions all over 30 years. This is a 30-year window we're looking at. So 30 years of contributions is the top line. And then the second line is showing what the unfunded liability would be at the end of those 3 years. This is all inflation adjusted. If you are able to look at that, you can add them together. And basically, we develop what we call an all-in cost. But it's basically you could just understand it as the price tag. Under no stress or stress applied that we can do. And there's a lot of different scenarios we can do with the model as well. We're just kind of giving you a snapshot to help you understand what the cost of this bill could be. So you'll see here, again, applying no stress, it's very easy to show that it basically would have no cost. And that's very likely to be what some analyses will show on this. But again, that's only assuming that the pension plan is able to achieve 7.25% every single year for 30 years. Now, again, applying the stress, which is below, you'll see the actual picture of what this reform could cost, what this rollback of reform could cost the state starts to emerge. You'll see that here we're looking at about $800 million over 30 years in added costs just to have that benefit for public safety workers. Okay, so I'm going to roll through this again with SB 11. SB 11 is very different because it opens up the pension plan for all workers. So that's all PERS and TERS workers, not just the public safety. So, of course, the impact of that is going to be much larger. You'll see here again with the stress applied, the peaks are going to be a lot higher, which means is that any time that there is a loss, the state's pension plans are going to suffer larger increases in their unfunded liability, much higher pension debt. And then with the stress applied, you're looking at unfunded liabilities that are still quite high. So what that basically means is you're making little progress to actually being able to fulfill those promises that are made. So using those, using that same modeling, here's the price tag, basically the price tag analysis that we're showing. With the plans opened up to all new members, our modeling shows that the state could be taking on up to $9.2 billion, or I should say upward of $9.2 billion in increased costs over the next 30 years. I say upward because this is, again, just with our stress analysis applied, which we believe is very probable to happen, and it could even be worse. So this isn't even worst case scenario that we're displaying. We're just showing something that we find to be kind of a good center ground to kind of base a cost analysis on. So the applying stress to the actual to the actual plans will show exactly what the state should be prepared to pay if they were to apply and roll back the reforms from 15, 16 years ago. All right, and lastly, I'll show you Senate Bill 88, which Senate Bill 88 also opens up the pension plans for all workers. This is the bill that would also apply some costs, I would call them cost-saving features into the bill. This is what Representative Gray and I were discussing earlier, some features that will actually help manage the increase in costs and help reduce some of the runaway costs as well. The modeling actually shows some interesting things here. Despite all the measures that are taken in the reform to reduce those runaway costs, there's actually very little difference. And this graph isn't going to tell you much. You kind of have to see them back to back from the last one, but the next slide will help you a lot. But the short story here is that it does reduce some of the costs, but not a lot when you actually look at the large picture of it. Let's look at the next slide. This is, again, the price tag of what we'd be looking at with SB 88. The very bottom line there, you'll see the increase there is $8.6 billion. So remember, SB 11 was 9.2. This one's 8.6. So essentially those cost-saving measures in the reform could be saving, according to the stress scenario, around $600 million over 30 years. But that's dwarfed by the large amount that would be added to long-term budgets. So we're still looking at $8.6 billion added to the state's responsibility, basically, with this bill applied.
Before we move on, we have a question from Representative McCain.
Thank you. So through the chair, we talked a little bit about health care, and you guys are aware of our health care plan peripherally anyways, you know it. So with the standard stress, so you just did the standard modeling that anybody that does a normal actuary would do, and you came up with not even the worst case scenario, an $8.6 billion cost. Could we save enough on a healthcare plan to take up for that? Or is that just sort of a, I don't even know what to call it, gaslighting maybe, or smoke and mirrors? I'm not sure. Could we? Would it be helpful?
Through the chair, yes, Representative McCabe, the healthcare plan, there's probably no maneuver you could pull with that to backfill this cost. And that's really not how those are supposed to operate. Healthcare plans you can't really move those over to fulfill unfunded pension liabilities. They work separately.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, this is still Zachary Christensen talking, for the record. what I did want to show you now is an so we've shown you stress testing what the cost, the price tag of these reforms could look like. At this time, we also wanted to share with you some modeling that we've put together that compares the actual benefit that can be earned by individuals over the period of a career. This is also something that's complicated. There's a lot of moving parts, but we're able to, with our model, insert in a starting age of a new employee, their assumed growth in payroll, and several other factors, and show the actual benefit that they've earned up to a certain year. And I wanted to share that with you to kind of give you some context as to what, you know, if we were to compare the two benefits. I should also, as a disclaimer, defined contribution plans and defined benefit plans each have their own advantages and disadvantages. You know, there's a reason to use either one. We've worked with a lot of states that use either defined benefit plans or defined contribution plans. We've helped improve both types of plans. We've helped establish both types of plans in some states. So with that disclaimer, I think it is valuable to see who exactly a retirement plan is benefiting, who are you trying to help, and who may be at a disadvantage at any point. So let's take a look.
One other disclaimer is that this benefit modeling compares the DC versus the old defined benefit. It's not the defined benefits proposed in any of these bills. So it's simply looking at what the last tier of defined benefit has versus the newer tier for the DC.
Okay. So first of all, this is PERS non-public safety. We wanted to show this. This is a very large group, of course, of members in Alaska. The orange bar, of course, shows the DC annuity. So that's basically what we mean by that is after someone has saved up, saved their benefits, their DC benefits, and they're able to annuitize it at retirement, meaning they're able to buy a guaranteed monthly payment for in perpetuity. So it's a benefit that they can't outlive. We're doing that so that you can compare it to a defined benefit plan. That's one advantage that a defined benefit plan has, is that there's no what's called a longevity risk. You can't really outlive your benefits. Well, the same is actually also true with a DC plan or really any personal contribution plan, because you can still purchase an annuity at retirement and still receive guaranteed benefits. So we're trying the best we can here to compare apples to apples. It's kind of hard to do, but this is something that we're able to show here. You'll notice the DC annuity accrues a lot faster than the DB annuity. And it takes the DB annuity a lot of time to catch up, basically. DB plans are designed to benefit or to heap on a lot of the benefit of the promised benefits to those who are sticking around a longer amount of time. And then in particular around the 30-year mark here is that's about when it surpasses the DC benefit. Now, what this all means is that there's very few people that are going to be able to take advantage of that optimized DB benefit plan compared to the DC plan in this case.
Can we pause here for a question? What do we know about the change in our workforce with regard to how long employees are staying at a particular career? Has it changed over the generations, or what does it look like?
Mr. Chair, yes, it's absolutely changed over the years. I believe I saw a study. I wish I could remember the name, but I'll be sure to send it to you. That said, the average new hire expects to work 7 or 8 jobs during their career, whereas 20 years ago that number was 3. So, yeah, I think the demographics have changed quite a bit over the last 20 years.
Okay. Representative Eller?
Thank you. And I was going to go along that similar line that if it seems to me with the defined contribution, they could take it with them. And versus defined benefits, you might be forced to stay there, be miserable in your job, hate your life. But hey, I got defined benefits when I'm 65 years old and 15 years left to live. And I want to bring up a point that in the military, we have defined contributions now. And the reason we know why they're going there, but it's a good idea. And a lot of these young soldiers going in don't necessarily want to stay for the 20-year mark. And so they're giving these soldiers the choice and the option, and they're taking the defined contributions more because they can take it with them. So thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative McCabe.
So thanks, Chair. This is why they call it golden handcuffs. Because as a firefighter, when you're abusing your body and running into the fires and firefighting, you don't get to retire at 20 years with a defined benefit that's better than defined contribution. You have to wait until you've been with the fire department 30 years to even get 29 years to even get break even is what I'm seeing here. And if you were astute or had a really good investment advisor with your defined contribution, you could actually do better than this.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, just two things I think are important to talk about on this chart. One, this doesn't include public safety. That'll be the next chart. And since we are comparing the old tier of defined benefits, they actually had a 20 and out feature where it would actually probably work out better under that scenario. But really what you're seeing, the reason there's such a large gap here is because if a member works, let's say, 10 years in a defined benefit plan and leaves, that defined benefit doesn't magically grow over the next 20 years until they retire. It's frozen in place where it is, no matter what happens with inflation or anything over the next 20 years. When a member's in a defined contribution plan for 10 years and leaves, that account still grows along with them for the next 20 years, which is why those figures are so much higher.
Representative McKay.
So, and I think what you're saying, and I didn't know about the 20-year and out feature, sorry. But what you're saying is that once you retire with a defined contribution, you can continue to manage it. You're not stuck with a fund manager that's tied to maybe some other monetary issues within the state. You can take your defined contribution and say, I want to invest this much in real risky, maybe some overseas stuff, maybe some IT stuff. You can manage your what's left of your 401k even into retirement.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Chair Crumpter. Gentlemen, do I see correctly on the bottom that there's an assumed 7% return on this graphic?
Yes.
Okay, follow up.
Representative Groh.
How does that match up with the comments that you gentlemen made earlier this evening about how 7% was too high?
Through the chair. Yes. Representative Grove, that's a very astute observation. Yes, we had to select some type of return assumption here. 7% seemed fairly close to what was being selected right now to project out by the plan. But if we were to, and actually we're developing a tool where you can change this yourself. We'll distribute that with the committee once we have that ready, and it will be available on our website. You will be able to adjust down that assumption. And yes, you'll notice that that'll bring down those orange bars because they won't be growing as quickly as they are displayed here. So thank you for that question.
Please continue.
All right. Now, we showed you non-public safety, non-teachers. Ryan, my colleague Ryan mentioned that we do also need to show you public safety. They work the way that they retire. Their retirement requirements are very different. So it's you really do need to separate them out and show if we're going to make a fair comparison here between the two, what that would look like. You'll see here that the first 19 years are very similar to what we showed in the last chart. What happens here at year 20 is that's the 20, and again we're comparing the old DB plan to the current DC. They have the 20 and out feature there for public safety. And what we're doing there with the analysis to compare it apples to apples and to get as close as we can to a fair comparison here, we're assuming that the DC benefits accrued at that point are actually just cashed in for what would normally be a pretty early retirement. And that, of course, cuts down the annuity that you're able to purchase at that time since you're going to be purchasing an annuity for much longer. If the individual were to instead wait until their retirement age to start buying that annuity, the orange bar would look very similar to the last graph in this case. But so there's two different ways to display that basically, but we chose to go with this one just to be fair and make sure that we're displaying the comparative advantages that a pension can have under certain circumstances. Now, we should note as well that Most new workers that are going to be joining public safety are going to be new members of these public safety plans are going to fall in that latter part. 50% of new public safety hires are leaving within 10 years of service. So again, what it kind of drills down to what is the main question of what is the purpose of a retirement plan? What are you trying to achieve as legislators with the retirement plans that you've helped establish? And generally, we would say that pension plans should primarily benefit the largest group of people that you can. So that would be a good reasoning behind why you would possibly prefer a DC plan to a DB plan in this situation. But again, we do want to show that there are some advantages to a DB plan, although it's to much fewer people.
Through the chair, Ryan Frost again. There, and I also want to comment on a couple other things that are happening here. As Zachary mentioned, because they have the 20 and out feature, you're essentially having to spread out that DC annuity over, I think we would project probably 35 years at that point, so the number would be smaller. And then the DB for public safety ramps up much quicker because they have a kind of a graduated multiplier for certain years of service. And so that's why that's really jumping up in those later years.
Thank you. Please continue.
All right. And then lastly, for the teachers, again, all three of these were showing someone that's entering the workforce at age 30, or not the workforce, but entering their career as a teacher or public service agent at age 30, or assuming a 7% return. All of these can be adjusted because it's, we're just giving a small snapshot of what's how this would work for a lot of different people. If you're entering in different ages, different entry ages, different return assumptions, different annuity payouts, and the wage increase that you're assuming, that you'll see this shift a lot. We're just we're basically grabbing like what would be the baseline, like what most people would expect to see. But hopefully, when we have this tool available to you, we encourage you to experiment with it and send any questions our way to help explain any of this. But again, for teachers here, you're seeing a much faster accrual of benefits for the DC plan. And then once that retirement age eligibility is met, the DC plan, if the DC account were to be annuitized at that moment, it jumps back down. But this gives an idea, again, of what it would look like to accrue benefits between the DC plan and the legacy DB plan. And then, interestingly enough, with this one, by the end of a 30-year career, actually a teacher would again be – the DC plan would again be the optimal retirement plan between the two. And, I should mention, 70% of new teachers leave within 10 years of service, which is – so really when you're – you have to look at everything as a whole, but when you're in decision making, you should make sure you have that context in mind as well, that 70% of all new workers are going to fall, in between those first few, from 8 to 18 there is what we're looking at. So the main takeaways from all of this, we just threw a lot of information at you, so we're going to try to condense this down to a few key points and what we're leave you with a few things to take away from all of this. First of all, our actuarial modeling is extremely useful to be able to project out and to see exactly the impact that these reforms and a newly reopened pension plan for Alaska, what that could mean for state budgets and long-term costs. Again, for HB 22 and 35, which opens up the pension plan for public safety, we're projecting that the state could be on the hook for upwards of $800 million more than they are right now. For SB 11, upwards of $9.2 billion. That's PERS and TERS combined. And then for SB 88, which is also PERS and TERS combined, we're looking at a price tag upwards of $8.6 billion. And as we mentioned earlier, that's probably an underestimate, considering the assumptions that are being made for returns right now, and the fact that the things could be a lot worse than we're stressing right there in those particular situations. Pensions. second pensions, we don't believe there's the pensions are the solution to Alaska's recruitment and retention challenges. Ryan mentioned earlier we've done a work in several states. You'll notice you'll notice that all states are having issues with recruitment and retention at the moment. We understand that Alaska is unique in a lot of ways, and some of the challenges that you are facing, of course, are unique. But it is something that you'll notice nationwide is that retention is becoming harder and harder. Most of these states are operating with pensions still, and so it's hard to say that that would be the magic bullet that would fix this recruitment and retention challenge. We didn't hit on this too much, but it is something we can speak on. DC rates for public safety. There are some improvements that we've identified in a piece last year that we can send you a link to. We have had our experts look at the current DC plan, and there are some areas where that could be improved as well. That's something that could help and make sure that we're covering everyone the way that we should, in particular public safety. And along those same lines, the SBS is something that could possibly be expanded upon.
Pause for just a second. Representative
Ballard. To kind of go back on your point, you were saying that the teachers and police officers, they're not as many as they used to be. I hear a lot of folks say, no, I don't want to be a police officer. It's changed. Teachers, have you ran numbers or anything to find out if teachers, I hate to say it this way, but are like a dying breed along with police officers or fire departments or, you know, the main runners of wanting to find benefits?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, we haven't ran any analysis that looks at that specifically.
You think that, through the chair, follow up, do you think that's something that you guys could do or are looking to do in the future? Because those seem to be the biggest focus for, you know, state employees. I'm just wondering, to get those numbers out there and to compare, the lack of teachers might not be just because the lack of teachers, it's people aren't going back to school or people aren't going to college to be teachers. I don't know. It's just.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Allard, we actually scrape an enormous amount of municipal and state level data. And so maybe one of the things we could look at is kind of how many are being hired every year across the country compared to historical averages. I think that's something that we could do.
There's something that you said that I wanted to touch on. A question here regarding how many states have moved away from a defined benefits plan to a defined contributions plan, and compare that number, the remaining states that have defined benefits plans, and how many of them are struggling with recruiting and retention.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair. That's a great question. How many states have moved to a DC plan from a DB plan? The count is a little tricky because some have gone all in, some have gone half in, so there's a lot of half counts there, but the ones we've worked with, Florida has changed, has basically changed their default to a DC plan. So that's become the primary, while still giving an option for a DB plan. There's been a lot of states like Colorado that have kept their pension plan as the primary, but still have that optional DC plan. They haven't expanded it out as much as we think it would be great because it's not available to everybody. It's available to legislators, but not to teachers in Colorado for some reason. There's also states that we've helped with that have made sure that there's that optional DC plan just side by side for everybody. How many have gone over that? Oh, Oklahoma is a great one to mention as well. They've developed what's called the Pathfinder retirement program, similar to what Alaska did, they closed their defined benefit their pension plan to future workers, and have since then seen it's not just because of that, because they also threw in a lot of money in there, rightfully so. They really doubled down to make sure that they're covering the promises that were made and covering those legacy costs. But since then, since they've switched, they've made a huge amount of progress on funding their pension plan, and now they're basically fully funded in Oklahoma. And they're even looking at possibly doing a similar reform for the teachers in Oklahoma as well. What they did before was for all other public workers.
The chair, Brian Frost, Michigan also was the first state to go DC for public employees in 1997, And then, as Zachary mentioned, there's been a lot of kind of things between a defined benefit, defined contribution that plans have gone to either a hybrid. Probably 30 plans have gone to having at least a hybrid option. All new Texas state employees are in a cash balance plan, which is, it is a defined benefit plan, but it's based on your account balance when you retire. So it's kind of in between there. But I think those are probably the biggest ones.
How many states are moving from a defined contributions plan to a hybrid or a defined benefits plan?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So historically, all we can do is look back historically on these. Only one state has switched to a DC plan and then later on reverted back and to undo that reform. And that was West Virginia. And that was, I believe, in 2007 or so when they switched back. I might have to follow up with you on that because my history is not great. But they did switch back. What West Virginia is a bit of a warning of what can happen if you do switch to a DC, but you just ignore the funding issues that will still remain for the pension plan. They did switch to a DC, but they did nothing to actually help fulfill the pension promises that were made up to that point before the switch. And so they continued to accrue and build up unfunded liabilities, pension debt, and then eventually they decided to switch back.
Thank you. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm wondering if you can get us the actuarial assumptions that were made to come up with the $800 million, the $9.2 billion, and the $8.6 billion. If we can see your actuaries work, that would be very helpful, I think, at least to me, to see that work.
Through the chair to Representative Gray, absolutely, yeah, we can put those together. I will mention all cards are on the table here as much as we can at the moment. We are, for the most part, using all the same assumptions that the plan does in their actuarial evaluations. So we're using all of the same assumptions for payroll growth, how long they're going to stick around in the plan, how long they're going to live, things like that. The only thing that we did change was that assumption is for returns.
Okay, thank you. Follow up?
Representative Gray.
I'd also just like to mention that I've heard you use the term rollback a few times, that we're rolling back from a DC to a defined benefit, but we are actually going to a new system. Our new defined benefit system, as we've talked about, is much more conservative. And because it's much more conservative, it really doesn't have the same liabilities that we had prior to 2006. So it's just probably me just playing semantics, but that term rollback implies sort of that we're going back to the old system and we're not. And if it's okay, I have one more follow up.
Yeah, I think it's really important on getting your marketing correct.
Thanks.
Representative Gray.
So the last thing I would just state is that through the chair, I had a very good friend at the VA. She and her husband were planning on retiring in 2010. They had managed their 401k very well. 2008, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. They lost over half their 401k's value over the course of a week. I know her at the VA because she came to work at the VA because she had a defined benefit retirement, and she's 13 years after she planned to retire is still there. I think for me, the overarching message is that with a defined contribution, if the stock market crashes and people lose all their retirement, doesn't hurt the state. No big issue. And I think, with the defined benefit, you have workers who, when they're elderly, would know they could rely on a paycheck to pay for their electricity and their food. But there might be some liability taken on by the state. With the defined contribution, that elderly person may not be able to afford their bills. What the state would say is, well, you know what? That teacher didn't invest right. She was too aggressive at T. Rowe Price. And you know what? That's her fault. She should have invested better, not the state's fault. And I think, that person who's starving, but the least they can say is like, well, I don't have enough money for food, but I know my state hasn't gone into debt. That government didn't take on any extra liability. That's really sort of how I simplify it in my head. Am I getting it wrong?
It's okay to say yes.
And teach me through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I agree partially in that the risk of a DC plan is on the member, absolutely. I don't know if that is a very common occurrence where somebody was still 2 years before retirement was losing invested in losing half their money. But, I mean, that is not a good situation by any means. And as far as the DB plan, yes, the state does take on more of the risk. As we've mentioned, there is a little bit of variable rate there where the employee can take a little bit more. But so I guess I would say partially agree, absolutely, and that is at the basic definition of risk, that is the difference between the two.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. Through the chair. This is kind of a little bit of an out there question, but I think it's very relevant. When working for the feds, you can't use marijuana. And we have it legalized in the state of Alaska. So do you think that our recruitment is impacted by the legalization of marijuana? Because if you smoke it, you don't qualify for certain lines of work. Have you taken that into consideration of a recruitment problem in any of the other states?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, we haven't looked at that. No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
You can't add that into an actuarial?
It makes, but I mean, through the chair, doesn't it make sense though? Because if I'm smoking marijuana, I can't just go walk in and work for the APD. I don't know all their rules, but I'm pretty sure that there's a stipulation of how long and since I haven't used it. I know for the feds, it was 10 years. You can't have used marijuana for 10 years. And in fact, in the state of Alaska, the FBI couldn't even hire mechanics to come in and work for the FBI because they used in the last 10 years. Maybe they put some waivers in there, but I think that's very significant with the argument of people say, oh, we can't recruit people. Well, there might be good, valid reasons why. So I think that, were you being sarcastic or could we put that in?
No, I was being sarcastic.
Oh, well, I mean, you can throw in the weather. You can throw in isolation up here. You can throw in the darkness. There's a whole bunch of reasons why people want to leave. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why people want to stay. So I think that's, we are unusual. And based on that, there's a reason why we are the least, are we? Least populated state, perhaps Wyoming. Okay, I'm done. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Allard.
He just did a raise to the ceiling.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. So I think if we look back several slides and we look at 2008, which is what Representative Gray was talking about, we see that the state suffered immensely. It's not like the state has unlimited money. So if we compare that, and I know that the state can't go bankrupt under Title IX, I get that, but they can default on a plan, and I think we will see that the state had the same issues as his friends in their 401k. The state doesn't have unlimited money. I don't think, just because if you do look at Detroit, I think you will see that just because they relied on Detroit, they relied on the city, some of them had the same problem. In fact, some of the people, when that happened in Detroit, had to pay money back to their plan. So there are several states right now. Alaska is per capita the highest state, higher than CalPERS in what we owe. That kind of brings up one point that I'm curious on. You said $6.1 billion for unfunded on our retirement. I think I saw a presentation from our legislative finance that it was more like $7.2 billion, $7.1 billion. And I think the governor, OMB, has something out that says $3.5 billion. So I'm curious where you got your data from. Was it directly from the retirement system is what I assume, because they're probably the most accurate, right?
Yeah, through the Representative McCabe, that's exactly right.
Okay.
I believe the $3.5 billion is combining the health care funds and the pension funds together.
Oh, I see. So OMB added that healthcare in, and it dropped it significantly, and that's where that comes from. That's kind of important for everybody that's watching to know. So I got to say it again, and I've said it several times. I can't think of a worse entity on this planet to manage my retirement system than the state of Alaska legislature. I just can't. It doesn't matter who they hire. It doesn't matter if it's Buck, if it's Fidelity. The legislature, at the end of the day, still has ultimate control. They can shut it off. They can turn it on. I get the Constitution says that they have to pay it. But, I mean, we're in a huge fiscal crunch right now. And that's why we're discussing it. So, anyways.
Thank you, Representative McCain.
Rant over.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Can we go to slide 22? through the chair. I have two questions about this slide. So the state of Alaska's actuaries have been assuming that our past service costs, our unfunded liability, would be fully paid out by 2039. But I see that orange line extending out to 2052. So my first question is, I mean, I assume that you think your actuary is right and the state of Alaska's actuary is wrong.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, that's not what that's showing. So the debt will be paid off in 2039 as long as all the assumptions are hit. If they're not, then that gets pushed out farther. And that's what this is showing.
Follow up. My second question is, when I follow your lines from 2021 to 2022, it looks like you're at about $6 billion. And I know that that's double what I'm hearing, again, from other sources in the building. So my question is, what's your source for the current $6 billion unfunded accrued liability?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, it's from the PERS actuarial valuations. That is the pension debt in the trust fund right now. They have, if we could split it out by assets versus liabilities, it could show you the gap. But this is what the pension debt is. The numbers you're seeing, as I was saying to Representative McCabe, the lower number is when the trust funds for the pension and the healthcare are being mixed together, because the healthcare fund is overfunded and the pension fund is underfunded. And then when you combine them, then it's a lower number.
And thank you.
Through the chair, to Representative Gray, just to grind this down to the very minuscule level of accuracy detail that we're looking for here, for 2021 is the latest numbers that we have that's been publicly reported. So we are applying we're applying the latest return that's been reported in 2022 to the data that we have. So the public reports may come out a little different than what we showed. I'm talking about just this one little point in 2022. Maybe slightly different, but it probably won't be. No, it'll be close to that.
Brian Frost, one other point is that I'm assuming the investment board probably publishes quarterly or monthly reports. So you're going to be able to see the plan's assets by quarter or month to see how they're tracking. And then when the valuation comes out, that's kind of when they get matched up with the liabilities. But for the most up-to-date number, dollar figure of the plan's assets, those monthly and quarterly reports are really useful. So you can see kind of the track over the last year. Has the plan earned money the last year? Has it lost money?
Okay. I think I started the interruption of your main takeaways. Do you have a couple more main takeaways that you want to hit on?
We left off the DC rate for public safety. Could be approved just due to the shorter career. As Zachary was mentioning, we had a piece published late last year that we have two members of our staff who worked for TIA for 20, 30 years, know more about DC plans than anybody else in the country. And they looked at kind of what the DC rates are for Alaska public safety members versus what they would say is probably the best practice. And there's maybe a small gap there where it could be improved. The next bullet, the granting all employees access to the SBS, I know that's would make Alaska's pension plan some of the best in the country. I'm unaware of any other state that offers a Social Security replacement like this good. It essentially matched the Social Security rates going back, but whatever mechanism they use, a 403B, 401K for this SBS, whatever it is going to dwarf the returns that Social Security is going to give you for that same amount of money. I know it's another 6% from the member and 6% from the employer. So obviously that needs to be taken into consideration when you're talking about a total benefit package and how the affordability of everything. But for members that don't have Social Security, having access to that benefit would, I would be hard to find many pension benefits with the current DC with that benefit that would be Alaska's.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, through the chair. Maybe this is a fine point, but we keep hearing that the teachers or those that don't have Social Security want to go back to Social Security. I think what I just heard you say is that SBS is better than Social Security.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, in my opinion, based on basic and any kind of benefit accrual you could look at, Social Security invests in essentially bonds and gives you a defined benefit based on however many years, that's a whole other multiplier. But the dollars that you would put in over your career to Social Security compared to the dollars you would put in over SBS are similar, but the benefit you would get from the SBS under almost, I mean, any return rate above a bond rating would be, frankly, much better than Social Security.
Thanks.
Representative Allard.
I'm going back to Social Security. When I worked for the Social Security Administration back in 2013, they made it clear that Social Security was going to end approximately 2033. So unless that's changed, then the SBS would be better.
through the chair, Representative Allard, yeah, when Social Security does run out of money, it essentially will act as the same as if a trust fund ran out of money for a defined benefit plan, where every dollar we're all putting in no longer gets invested in the market. It's going straight out the door, goes to government, out the door to pension checks. And that would be the same if a pension trust fund ran out of money. You couldn't default on the obligations. You would just, instead of having any form of contributions to earn investments over a member's career, which is how it's supposed to work, your contributions would go straight to the trust fund and out the next month to benefit checks.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Please continue.
Where were we at? So the current DC plan, as we mentioned earlier, greatly benefits members who don't work a full career with the same employer. I think that's probably fairly understood as the one of the main differences between DB and DC. And then lastly, going back to the problem one I highlighted, is that while they do include some risk-reducing policies compared to the old legacy tiers, they still, in our opinion, don't have quite don't go far enough if you're talking about opening up a new defined benefit pension plan from a plan that currently has no risk, and that is the minimal cost sharing, so essentially not having the 50-50 cost sharing that we've seen most plans have, not really aligned with market expectations, and then also no improvements to the amortization policies, which means there's no improvements to how the state would, if the new tier were to have debt, it still is spreading it out over the old amortization schedule, where most actuaries, the Society of Actuaries, recommend not spreading out debt more than 10 or 15 years. Because the interest payments you pay in those later years just kill you.
Cool.
With that, be happy to answer any more questions.
Okay, we got about 10 minutes left.
Can we beat them up some more?
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for coming out here to help us with understanding defined benefits and defined contributions as we contemplate a long-term fiscal plan. Representative Allard.
I do. Can I make one comment to you? Thank you. Thank you, through the chair. It was very interesting because in one of our hearings in our committee is state affairs. The individual that was testifying, another representative, in regards to how great the defined benefits in HB 22 was, actually used your reasoning and all reason, but anyways, your article in favor of it. But then it wasn't actually exactly what you said. And then all of a sudden, you guys didn't matter anymore. And that your analogy and your data didn't make any sense and it was thrown out. So I just want to say again, thank you, too. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Cade.
And yeah, I'd like to thank you, too, gentlemen, as well. I appreciate it. And I know we've had some hard questions, and I appreciate any additional data you can get to us. I've sort of been keeping up, but any additional data that you can get to us would be awesome. And so I appreciate it. If there's nothing else, Mr. Chair, I have a suggestion.
Representative Cape.
So after last Wednesday's presentation on education and the BSA and this evening's presentation from these two fine gentlemen, I think we should take a deeper look into the impact of other alternative options for education and retirement funding. The chart that we had, or the modeling thing that we sort of were promised from Ledge Finance very early in this, or not promised, but he said he would work on it. So if the committee wants to work on education choice options for parents that improve children's outcomes and also have the benefit of reducing education costs, and if we want to work on defined contribution options for teachers and police and firefighters, I think I would like to ask you and your staff to work with Director Painter to add onto the fiscal model alternative options for education and retirement benefits. No marijuana, though. and also to create a list of scenarios for alternative options for education retirement benefits that would show potential numbers or what impacts they could have in the long-term fiscal plan. I said at our very first meeting how helpful that was for me to understand where the state was going and for me to understand what making a 1% change over here, what it did at the final outcome. And I think it would be very helpful for all of us to understand going forward what a change in DB would do, what a change in BSA would do. And I know what Mr. Painter said, well, it's just $27.3 million, but it's helpful to see it in the model. So that would be my suggestion.
Since you're not making a motion, it's not an action before the committee. I will take it as a friendly suggestion, and I will. I think it's a good idea. It fits into the narrative that we've had all the way back to the fiscal policy working group, which was, what is it that we need to do comprehensively to solve this political problem we have with the structural imbalance? And the what I have added on to is that we need to consider whatever it is we do grows our economy. And so I think that that fits into that narrative. So I will have a conversation with Director Painter, and we'll see what we can do. Thank you for the suggestion. Any other comments or tonight? Okay. Well, then it is 7:54, and this meeting is adjourned.